Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and thanks for joining us this week on Soundbites, our weekly look at our food, our environment, and our future, produced here at WEAA 88.9 FM in Baltimore. Today on Soundbites, I talk with Michelle Chen, contributing editor at In These Times and associate editor of Culture Strike, about a startling statistic that 1 in 3 of all restaurant workers are food insecure. There's a study done in San Francisco and New York. That's coming up on Soundbites. But first, we learn about a proposal for a manure-burning plant in the Eastern Shore, and the project itself might be in limbo, and hear arguments against this type of proposal and for it.
There's been a lot written in the press, and we've been talking a great deal over the last year or so about the idea of chicken manure being turned into energy and the controversy surrounding that. And the difficulty, it seems, to get that going in the state of Maryland, even though it's going in a couple of places overseas and a few places in America. We're joined by Patrick Thompson. Pat Thompson is president and CEO of Energy Works Group, based in Annapolis, Maryland, who's been involved in this for a while. Pat Thompson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Ann Swanson is Executive Director of the Chesapeake Bay Commission. And Ann, great to have you back with us again. Thank you so much for being here.
And thanks for having me.
And once again, Tim Wheeler joins us, who is reporter for the Be More Green reporter for the Baltimore Sun. And Tim, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So let's begin here. And I wonder, Tim Wheeler, just to start us off, a little history. I mean, this whole issue we have clearly in Maryland and many other places about the amounts of phosphorus that are dumped into our waterways and the political battles that's taken between farmers and environmentalists and others in the state of Maryland, the phosphorus management tool that was supposed to be implemented, it didn't get implemented. And in the midst of all this is this idea of a green power plant built on chicken manure. So give us a bit of the history of what this is about and where we've come to.
Well, the idea of a plant that would burn chicken manure to generate electricity has sort of grown out of folks casting around, I believe, for a good solution, or one that's that works, a workable solution to the ongoing, long-lasting problem of restoring the Chesapeake Bay, which is suffering from an overabundance of nitrogen and fertilizer, the two plant nutrients that fuel our algae blooms and dead zones. We haven't made all the progress we need to, and there's still a significant shortfall. And I guess over the last 20 some years, we've come to realize that that agriculture, particularly in the last decade, is not making as much progress as it could. They're not the only ones, but also a realization that after thinking that we had taken care of phosphorus, that we really haven't, that it's been building up in the soil from widespread use of poultry manure as a fertilizer, and that it's impacting water quality. So the idea was to try to find some alternative for using poultry manure as a fertilizer, and the idea thought here was that if you could convert it to energy, that maybe that was a win-win.
And so, Ann, what has been the difficulty here in getting this off the ground? And we'll talk about all the issues surrounding it, but it seems that this was going along with great guns, and Purdue, which we'll explore in a moment, was going to be part of this whole process. Things seem to fall apart. Now we're talking about giving more money, even more money to the industry itself to get started, and the complexities there. So what is happening here?
Well, I think that whenever you're trying to do something new, it always takes you a lot longer than normal. And right now, there are really serious phosphorus issues in the Chesapeake Bay, issues that are bad enough that some of the progress from the past is now being eclipsed. And so we need solutions like this. I think that the company that's been brought on to at least try to investigate develop this plant is having a series of issues associated with finding a location and getting all the correct permits lined up. But in fact, when and if it does go in, Maryland really needs a manure-to-energy plant, because Maryland has enormous production of poultry, and with it comes phosphorus-laden manure. And we need to use that manure in ways other than simply applying it to the crop fields, because many of those fields are now proving to be saturated. We're trying to move this plant forward, but it's had its obstacles.
And obstacles it has had, Pat Thompson. Did your company bid on this project?
No.
You did not?
We wanted to, but decided that the procurement process wouldn't allow us to make a full-fledged bid that we knew we could follow through on.
Right, and therein lies part of the problem some people think about why it's been so hard getting this off the ground, which we can explore with you a bit too. But talk about what this industry does. What does it do? I mean, we've read stories about the problems involved in the industry in terms of it causing its own pollution, which we'll talk about later, but also the difficulty in making money on this unless it's subsidized. Talk about what the process is and what we're talking about here.
Well, as a fuel, poultry litter and other types of manure are not great fuels. You typically have to condition them to make them process effectively, and it takes a lot of hardware to convert them into revenue streams that, or into products that can be monetized. And the sort of default revenue stream is electricity, because that's an established market which is highly accessible. There are other kinds of benefits which, frankly, have higher value when you look at the big picture in processing manure, and those things have to do with recycling of materials that you can recover and the air and water quality benefits that come out of them. But there are currently no good ways to monetize those benefits. So it takes something like what Maryland has done to prime the pump for this market.
And therein, to me, lies some of the problem here. I mean, that this is, in some ways, I know there's a plant in Minnesota, the plants in Pennsylvania, the plants in Britain, but it's untested technology that has its issues, not least of which is turning a profit.
Well, I would say the problem is less in the technology and finalizing the implementation of the technology than in figuring out how to monetize the benefit.
And you want to comment on that before I turn back to Tim?
I think the thing for the listeners to really understand is that when you're dealing with manure, manure has nitrogen in it and it has phosphorus in it. And it has more phosphorus than nitrogen. And so when you're applying it to the field to try to get green up, which is what nitrogen triggers, you know, that's what makes the plants really green and grow robustly, you're over-applying phosphorus. And so we can't put all the manure on the fields all the time. An alternative is to do this manure to energy. But it's not the best of feedstocks, so you have to look at the other benefits. What happens when you make manure to energy is the nitrogen ultimately goes up as just inert nitrogen gas into the atmosphere, which is completely part of air. And then the phosphorus is concentrated in an ash, which can be used for other purposes. And one of the things Patrick is talking about is we need to find the markets for this phosphorus-rich ash, whether that's elsewhere where the soils aren't saturated with phosphorus, or whether it's at a feed additive for chickens, or whether it's to top dress tomatoes. The point is that it's the suite of benefits, including pollution control, that matter in terms of manure to energy. So in some ways, just like a sewage treatment plant becomes part of government responsibility, as well as the people, you know, maybe manure to energy is one of those services that we make sure happens, because it's helping us to treat our chicken manure properly. At the same time, we get to be fed chicken. I mean, what most people don't realize is that the Delmarva Peninsula is one of the largest poultry producers in the nation, and with it comes a water quality responsibility.
That does beg some questions here. I mean, what you just raised, I want to throw a question to Tim Wheeler, but Tim, you can grab this first, and I'll come back to the question I was going to ask you about one of the kind of delays in this. But going back to what we just heard Ann Swanson say, I mean, public responsibility versus industry responsibility when it comes to things like phosphorus and who pays for these plants, who pays for this, I think is a huge question, because we're talking about investing. What is it now? I don't have the exact number in front of me. Is it like $90 million from the state into this facility? Would I have that right?
Well, the investment that the Green Planet Power Solutions says they're going to make in this project is $75 million. Technically, I mean, the state is not subsidizing this to a great degree, at least not yet. They put this out for a bid, and the company bid on it. The price that they bid was apparently in line with other renewable energy sources. So to the extent that the state is not subsidizing this anymore than it is wind and solar, but of course they are subsidizing those. The issue is this is almost an existential problem for the poultry industry in a way. What you're dealing with here is a huge oversupply of phosphorus in the Delmarva Peninsula, in Maryland's portion especially. The estimates that the state has put forward, if and when they ever begin to impose the phosphorus management tool to limit the amount of phosphorus that can be spread on these fields that have too much, they're going to need to find some place else to use more than 200,000 tons of stuff a year. And that's a lot of stuff. This plant is sized that it would use, according to the developers, 150 to 200,000 tons. So it would be a pretty near neat solution for it if it worked and if it could be done. But as you point out, they've been having trouble getting a site, and without a site, they can't get permits. They also need to solve the financing question. So the state is, in fact, now looking at perhaps trying to goose this along by offering them a higher price even than what they originally agreed to pay, which would be an increase in the subsidy.
You know, and I think in this situation, there's the industry has a responsibility to own their manure in the same way that they own their birds. The farmers have a responsibility. So do the people of Maryland if they want clean water and viable agriculture in this region. So I think the solution ends up being supported by a variety of sources.
This is Pat.
Go ahead, please, Pat. I was about to turn to you.
I think the real crux of it is that, as Ann just touched upon, is that the manure and its environmental effects, to a large extent, are externalities of the industry. And we know how to apply technology to solve the problem. One of the critical issues is that we have to prove that we're not trading air quality for water quality or water quality for air quality. So we have to do this right. Ultimately, what the industry is afraid of is the raising is incorporating the costs of this in their way of doing business and having to pass that cost on to the customers. So that's really what it's all about. And ultimately, it becomes a trade-off or a choice between cheap food and protecting the environment. And the question is how to achieve the proper balance. How is that? Who's going to pay? And how can you do this at least cost?
I was going to ask you again, Pat, and then turn back to Tim Wheeler for a moment, and Anne as well. You were quoted in Tim's article about this particular piece, saying you thought that the offer you made to the state was too they made to the state, the Green Planet, was too low to make the project work. You talked about the $30 million Pennsylvania put into your project, similar project in Pennsylvania, but then you said that it was, as I was trying to say earlier, that electricity couldn't turn the profit on this, and you had to turn to selling water quality and climate change credits with that areas for pollutions avoided by your plant, and then selling the byproduct for something else. So that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm questioning the whole question of what this means really for energy.
Well, it varies. There's actually a big difference between egg layer manure, which has very high moisture and no bedding material, and poultry litter, which is drier and has bedding material. It turns out that poultry litter is actually better, a better fuel, and can contribute more of the economics of the project through electricity than some other manures. So I think that the Maryland approach is makes sense, but I think that in our opinion and in the opinion of most of the other competitors in the bidding process were that it takes a high, the costs are higher than the Green Planet bid proposed. I'm sure that one of the things that the Maryland project would do, the Green Planet or the Clean Bay Power Project would do, would begin to commercialize this technology and allow the industry to get experience. And just like other forms of renewable energy, there's a learning curve, and the costs go down over time as we get more experience, learn how to manage the risks, get manufacturing efficiencies, optimize the design, and learn and are able to better monetize all the benefits out of the project.
We got a statement in just a little bit ago from Purdue itself, from Julie DeYoung from the Purdue company. And let me just read it and turn to Tim and then Ann to talk about what this means and where you think this goes and why it was so difficult for Purdue to get into this. It said, "We do not have an agreement to work with Green Planet Energy on Clean Bay Power Project in any role. We continue to explore alternative uses for poultry litter. and have looked at more than 60 different processes and projects. We've talked with 3 different groups in just the last week. We prefer not to say who we are talking with unless we get to the point of having a formal agreement. It's just too speculative to say anything until then. That was from Julie DeYoung that she sent over to us just now from Purdue. So, Tim, what is this issue between Purdue and the original agreement that we thought was in place to make this happen with the company that won the bidding, Green Planet? What's happening here?
Well, it's a little murky because the parties aren't being totally forthcoming about what's going on here, and perhaps that's in order to preserve a little bit of diplomacy so they may still reach some kind of working agreement. Purdue, of course, teamed up with FiberWatt to submit a competing bid for this plant, and they lost out at the outset. The Green Planet Power Solutions, shortly after winning the award, it appears, turned back to Purdue and attempted to work out an arrangement with them, because when they finally negotiated a power purchase agreement to fulfill this contract award, the Purdue site, a site in Salisbury that I believe was a Purdue property or near the Purdue property, was listed as the location for this plant. That also fell through. That's the second location that the company was trying to line up, and that did not work. And now they're looking for yet another site further down on the lower shore that they don't identify. So they have talked to Purdue. They told me this, that they had talked to Purdue about supplying them with poultry litter. They talked to others, apparently, also about supplying. And Purdue is not the only outfit that controls the poultry litter out there. And so they hear them tell it, they don't actually control any of it, though they do recycle some of their growers' litter into pelletized fertilizer pellets.
And there is a crux that lies a part of the issue, Ann Swanson. Who owns this litter? Whose responsibility is it?
Well, in terms of who owns this litter, essentially the big companies, Purdue and Tyson and Mountain Air, they essentially own the birds, and then they bring the birds to the farmers along with the food, the medication, et cetera. And the growers then, the farmers, they grow them according to that company's specs. But the farmer is then responsible for the manure. And so you're on to something, which is, we need to have more of a relationship between the industry and the farmers. If you look at Maryland's situation in terms of phosphorus, Maryland has 12 counties with greater than 65% phosphorus loads, and so 9 of them are on the Eastern Shore. So most of that is associated with poultry application. So siting a facility on the Eastern Shore makes a lot of sense. And what the O'Malley administration is trying to do is spot on. The question is, if it's not GPPS, if they cannot bring this project to fruition, then should we turn to another company that can? And it's really that question, because the sooner Maryland has an alternative to transporting manure, and can, in fact, be turning it into energy and its viable byproducts, the better we'll be. We, in many ways, can have our cake and eat it, too, in that we can have chickens and we can also have clean water.
Patrick Thompson, just a closing thought from you here about where you think it goes from here and what the viability will be.
Well, I have no doubt that the technology is viable. We're conducting tests at our Gettysburg facility this week and have observers from Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Maryland to look at the emissions, the air emissions, and to observe the rest of the process in operation. And we know that the emissions themselves can be dealt with existing technology. And we're looking at exactly what kind of technologies are the best economically for a project in Maryland. So where it goes depends on the outcome, as Ann just described. Either Green Planet or someone else can put together a project that will work. They need to find a suitable site. The complexity of the problem, and part of what's contributed to the delays in getting this done, is that there are many, many stakeholders here. And not every stakeholder has equal bargaining power in working out the solution. So there's a role for the state, I think, in helping coordinate a solution that works for the integrators, works for the power plant developer, and works for the growers, and works for the environmentalists.
So if Green Planet does fall through, do you then rebid and come back?
I don't know whether a rebid would be required or whether there would be a way for Green Planet to work with another company that has been deemed acceptable by the state to work with them.
So, Anne, were you trying to say, have a final thought here? I thought I heard you breaking in.
Well, you know, I just think in terms of the view, the listeners, they need to understand the magnitude of the chicken industry. And I looked at the USDA website, and in 1950, there were 581 million chickens sold in this country. And then in 2007, there were 8.9 billion chickens sold. And those are American-grown chickens. And so, you know, it doesn't take a lot of creativity to understand that is a lot more manure. And that's why the old practice of applying it to the fields alone is not sufficient. Can apply it to fields. It's a great thing for fields when the soil's not saturated. But when it's saturated, it acts like a sponge with too much water and simply lets it go into the runoff. And we can't have that.
The industry has become industrialized in order to provide the quantity of supply at consistent quality and a low cost. And that's resulted in large-scale operations. And unfortunately, the manure gets concentrated along with these large-scale operations. What we've learned is that you can't simply scale up the old methods of managing manure. The methods of managing manure involved storage and land application. That simply won't work because we end up with air pollution, water pollution, loss of valuable minerals like phosphorus, and threats to public health and safety. So we need to finish the industrialization of these processes by adding features that make these zero waste production systems. This is happening in all kinds of industries, and it needs to happen in the case of poultry and other parts of agriculture, but poultry lends itself more readily than any other animal types to industrialization.
There's one sort of missing component in this equation that nobody's talking about, and it's, you know, maybe this is where your opponents come into this issue. They have, the equity issue, too. They want to know why the industry isn't paying the freight for this stuff. And that's the hang-up in getting the phosphorus management tool in place, as you well know, is that the industry's complaining that this is going to put them out of business.
Right.
The poultry-to-energy plant, solves one piece of that. It takes care, if it got built and can make money, it would take care of the excess manure. It could potentially remove it from the watershed in a way that would basically take care of almost all the needs. The missing piece, however, and that helps those farmers in the sense that they don't have to pay somebody to clean out their houses and to take the, dispose of the manure or the litter. But they already have that with Purdue, at least the Purdue growers do. They can basically ask Purdue to take it away, and Purdue will generate their recycle stuff there, which they're losing money on. The problem comes in that all those growers who are using poultry litter, to raise crops. And if they can no longer use it, they're going to have to buy inorganic chemical fertilizer that costs more. And so there's going to be a cost associated with this, at least on the crop growers and on Maryland agriculture in general. And the question there is, is that going to be too great a burden to keep them afloat? And should the state or anybody subsidize that piece of it in one way or another?
I want to thank the three of you very much. This has been a fascinating conversation, and we'll go back to much more of this with you all in the coming weeks and months. You just heard Anne Swanson. She is Executive Director of the Chesapeake Bay Commission. Patrick Thompson is President and CEO of Energy Works Group, based in Annapolis, Maryland. Tim Wheeler is the Be More Green reporter for the Baltimore Sun. And we'll connect to his article online and to the work of the Bay Commission and to Patrick Thompson's companies and others on our website, steinershow.org. Thank you three so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you.
You listen to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, agriculture, and the environment here on the Mark Steiner Show. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back with more of Soundbites in just a moment. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Soundbites, our weekly look at our food, our environment, and our future, produced here at WEAA 88.9 FM in Baltimore. So we continue our conversation here about chicken manure to waste and what that would mean for the state of Maryland and what that means for the country, given one of the stats we heard in our last conversation, which is in 1950, there were 581 million chickens sold in the United States of America, broilers, and in 2007, the number was 8.9 billion. And it's a huge industry here in the state of Maryland. And we are joined now by Michelle Merkel, who is co-director of Food and Water Justice for Food and Water Watch. And Michelle, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. I'm happy to be on.
So given that, as one of our guests said earlier, that when you look at the world of chicken manure and chicken litter and phosphorus and nitrogen, he said you can't do what we've always done. You can't store it. You can't continue applying it on the land. On the other side, someone said, no, you can't apply it on the land, but then something else is done with it, then farmers have to pay more for organic fertilizer, chemical fertilizer, than they do for the manure they use. So where do you go with all this? I mean, my understanding is that Food and Water Watch has issues with the development of manure energy, but they're trying to look at this as a way to find an answer to the millions and millions of pounds of chicken manure that we're faced with.
Yeah, we think having citizens in Maryland and other states asking them to finance poultry litter incinerators is a false solution and just another workaround for our real problem, which is we have too many animals on too little land on the eastern shore and other parts of our country. And as you mentioned, they're producing far more waste than can be adequately managed. But instead of reducing the number of animals that we're raising in these small geographic locations, we are instead trying to figure out a workaround for this problem and trying to figure out what to do with the waste. We think that the incinerators are problematic for a number of reasons. First, we think that they're not really solving the problem that we're trying to solve for. So litter incineration or these power plants do little to reduce the manure nutrient content. So while some of the nitrogen might be combusted, virtually none of the phosphorus is. So in the ash, you have not only all of the nutrients, the phosphorus included, but you also have now concentrated your heavy metals and other chemicals that were in the manure before the combustion process. And so this byproduct, the ash, still needs to be disposed of. And we've heard companies talk about, you know, selling it as fertilizer, which, again, we've got, you know, we're presuming that you're going to find a market for it when we know certainly we have too much manure in this watershed. We know that in other parts of the country we have the same problem. The second problem we see is that you're creating a new waste stream. So not only are you solving your water problem necessarily, but your burning poultry litter may actually create emissions that are worse than incinerators that burn more conventional fuel sources. So when we started looking at this, the only other poultry litter incinerator or power plant was in Benson, Minnesota, and their emissions included particulate matter and carbon monoxide and dioxides and heavy metals. And when we looked at the emissions inventories, the poultry litter plant was actually permitted to produce more carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide than either existing or new coal plants. And they produce more volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxide, all these toxic chemicals and pollutants. They produce more of those types of chemicals than existing coal plants. So not only are you solving your main environmental problem of concern, you're creating new waste streams that could really harm people living near these plants. And then third, we don't think it's economically viable without significant taxpayer subsidies, and we don't think that the citizens should be asked to keep bailing the industry out of its massive waste problem by financing these kind of false solutions. So in addition to the funds from the Maryland Clean Bay Power Projects, the new plant could potentially qualify for tax credits worth hundreds of thousands of dollars through Maryland's Clean Energy Production Tax Credit. Even in Tim Wheeler's article, EcoCore built a plant in Pennsylvania recently, and even he said, you know, the electricity isn't enough to turn a profit. So we don't think, again, we think these companies that own the birds that are producing this waste should be required to manage the waste and pay for a disposal, and it shouldn't be done on the backs of citizens. And finally, we just think manure-to-energy systems aren't part of a sustainable solution for industrial ag waste. We think it may perpetuate the production of excess manure, because once you sort of build the beast, you have to feed it. So we may actually increase consolidation of these chicken operations, where consolidation is also already a major problem, by building these types of facilities.
So if we know we have this problem, though, and the industry is not going away tomorrow morning, then you have to have some solution. I guess what people are saying is that these plants, A, they're saying that they are now developing the technology that they're going to be showing apparently the next couple of days in Pennsylvania that will ameliorate the pollution coming out and the heavy metals and toxins coming out. And B, that phosphorus can be used for lots of products once you get it out. But if we are producing this amount of chicken waste, there has to be some solution, which is why they're looking to this, which is a separate question of who pays for it, which we can talk about in a moment. But so it's a real issue. So what do you do with it all if it's not going to be used for energy, and especially if they say they can create a plants that will actually do this without destroying the environment?
Well, I mean, two things. In the long term, like you said, we think state legislators and policymakers should support the shift away from this industrial food system and the overwhelming amount of waste it's producing by helping to build economic infrastructure needed for smaller, independent, more diversified, you know, farmers to thrive more in these regionalized food systems and have a system that protects the environment and workers and consumers. Like you said, that's not going to happen overnight. In the meantime, though, we should be passing laws and enforcing laws that require the industry itself to pay for, to manage its waste. And if that means Purdue has to pay the cost to ship its waste to Haiti, where they need nutrients, then so be it. But it shouldn't be, I feel like we keep trying to have these workarounds that aren't fixing the problems. They're not actually addressing the problem of too many operations. I mean, we should have a moratorium in Maryland until and not allow expansions of existing facilities until they get a handle on the waste problem. And these companies should be required to figure it out. As I mentioned, we don't think these power plants do the trick. I mean, the one that's been operational for the longest time in Benson, Minnesota, hasn't been able to solve their problem. So I'm not as familiar with the EcoCore plant in Pennsylvania that's relatively new, but I'd definitely be interested in learning more about it. I mean, so far there aren't the markets. So, for example, you know, Purdue has had a pelletizer plant in Delaware for years, and the state of Maryland and Delaware, we pay Purdue to pick up its waste that it should be responsible for, that they drive it to the pelletizer plant to try to make a profit off of it.
What do you mean we pick up the cost of them picking up the pellets?
Well, there's something called the manure transport program. So we pay Purdue to pick up its own waste. We pay them to take it to this pelletizer
plant. We who? We the state of Maryland? The citizens?
The state of Maryland, taxpayers, yep. Then they have a pelletizer plant that's supposed to, again, turn it into fertilizer, kind of like this ash from a power plant would be sold as fertilizer. But they have not been able to make a profit off of that plant. And again, I don't know if it's they don't want to pay the high manure transport costs or the pelletizer costs. They don't have a market for it. But if there was a market for a byproduct from manure that could be used as a fertilizer, for example, you know, Purdue would be making money hand over fist at its pelletizer plant, and it's not. And so I think there's these false assumptions that there's a market out there that doesn't exist at the moment, that hasn't been proven to exist, or these alternative uses that haven't been proven to exist.
But when people would argue back at you, Michelle, or others who were raising these very serious questions about what this would mean and what it could mean, I think the point you raised about who pays for this moving the litter was really important, that most people haven't heard before, I think. But then what do you do with it? I mean, it's one thing to say to Purdue you have to pay for it, or Mount Air or Tyson, whoever that is, but what do you do with it? I mean, I guess people were trying to argue that this is one way to address the problem of not letting it get into the water, not letting it pollute our entire state. What's the argument against trying to make this work?
We haven't seen it work, but again, I think these workarounds that we are keep looking at, the problem is they haven't worked, and you continue to ask, again, the citizens to bail out these companies who are making money hand over fist, like Purdue, like Nonair. I mean, every other industry has to deal with its waste, right, if they're allowed to operate, and so should Purdue. I mean, we have, for example, the phosphorus management tools out there that should be law. That's not law because the industry's pushing back, so they don't know what to do with their waste. But in the meantime, farmers are being allowed to overapply and continue to pollute the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, either they should be able to manage their waste product or they shouldn't operate. That's what we ask every other industry to do.
It does become a question of who owns and who pays for what. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. I mean, I think that this whole question of who owns this manure to start with, right now it's the farmers.
Right.
Right? And so, but the question people argue are the people who actually own the chickens, what's their role in this and how much they owe or not owe on the manure that's spewed out from the chickens that ends up in the fields or in these plants, if in fact they ever get built. That's another piece of this, and you're already describing who pays for us to transport it out. So what about this debate about who owns this?
Well, right now the industry is structured so that the large companies like Purdue and Mount Air contract with local farmers to raise their chickens. But these contracts are very one-sided in that the farmers by contract are required to manage their waste. They have to deal with the dead chickens, but Purdue and Mount Air walk away with the profits. So our contract growers in Maryland and elsewhere are living at or below the poverty line without second off-farm income. Purdue's managed to walk away from its waste, even though they own the chickens that produce this waste. And so one of the things we're saying is that, you know, until you're able to pass policies that diversify our ag system that will be beneficial for everyone, that these companies should be on the hook for helping to pay for their waste. For their, you know, Purdue made $4.6 billion in sales, and yet not only are they making profits on the backs of these contract growers, they're subsidized by the state of Maryland and by citizens, like I said, to transport their waste to pelletizer plants to try to make even more money. So they're walking away for the waste product in a way that no other industry has been able to do. Proponents of this manure to energy system talk about how it's going to solve our problems, even though the plants that exist today aren't demonstrating that they will. But what's been really frustrating for me is that we don't know the details of this plan. And according to the proposal that was accepted by the state, the plant's supposed to be put in Federalsburg. We know that that's no longer the case. Then they were trying to cut a deal with Purdue to put the plant in Salisbury. Now we know that's no longer the case. But we can't get any information so far, and the state's dragging its feet and providing it to us about where the plant's going to be located, which is an important part of the discussions citizens should be a part of, and what the details are, like what technology is it going to use? How is it going to solve the problem? Are there markets for this waste? We know that based on what's existing today, it's not working. We are prevented from having details about what's being proposed now to be able to be part of the debate about its merit, and that's been particularly frustrating.
Isn't that, though, part of the whole question of proprietary information, who owns this information in the middle of business deals? I mean, how do you make that transparent, and why should it be transparent?
When we first heard about the fact that the state was soliciting these proposals, we tried to get information about it, and we were told that until the bid was awarded, that the information would be withheld. But once Maryland entered in a contract through the Clean Bay Power Program with Green Planet Power Solutions in January of 2013, we were then able to obtain the information about like what they had submitted and what had been accepted. However, since then, even though the details have changed, we've been told that they don't have to submit an updated RFP. So as far as the public's concerned, based on the RFP, it's going to be in Federalsburg, this plant, and the technology wasn't yet identified. We now have been asking for updates to our public information request for communications between the state and Green Planet Power since the time we got our last, you know, release of documents. But we so far, you know, have had no luck in getting documents out of the agency, and we're continuing to pursue it. But, you know, even in Tim Wheeler's article, you might notice they didn't identify where they're looking to locate this plant. And I'm concerned that it's moving extremely quickly because the state has an interest in making this happen, and they have deadlines under the current contract to meet. But, you know, it's not happening with full transparency, which I think is extremely problematic.
We've just been talking with Michelle Merkel, who is a co-director of Food and Water Justice for Food and Water Watch. Joining us earlier, we talked to Patrick Thompson, Ann Swanson, and Tim Wheeler, and we hope in the coming weeks to bring this as a real debate discussion, perhaps if we can organize a real-time meeting on the Eastern Shore to talk about this as well, to really explore what we do with this chicken manure and what these power plants are really all about and where we take this in the future. Michelle Merkel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. And hobble, 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 hobble with your chin.
There ain't nobody here but us chickens. We're about to talk to Michelle Chen, who is a contributing editor to In These Times, associate editor at Culture Strike. She's also a co-producer of the Asia-Pacific Forum at Pacificus WBAI and Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast, and also writes for The Nation, where she posted this piece that was really, really fascinating. Nearly one in three restaurant workers suffers from food insecurity. And Michelle, welcome. Good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show. Michelle, it almost sounds like an oxymoron. It sounds like an impossibility, but to read a title that says one in three people who work in the food industry are food insecure.
It's definitely underscoring a real paradox in our food system. You know, to be clear, restaurant workers are not the only low-wage workers suffering from food insecurity, but the report is pretty insightful by showing that you know, even people who are around food all day, whose livelihoods are based on food, don't have access to the good food, often the very same good food that they are serving to more affluent people in their restaurants.
But the issue seems, I mean, I guess what strikes people odd at 1 in 3 is even when you look at the national stats that you talk about in your piece, that about 30% of people in America are food insecure. This is a much higher number. In some ways. I mean, it's inching up because 1 out of 3, and I've read another study that even puts it higher.
It's interesting. I mean, there are different ways to kind of measure it, but I think the group that put out the report, Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York, and along with the Food Chain Workers Alliance and Food First, they were kind of using the federal definition that the USDA uses, which is basically food security is when you have access essentially at all times to good, healthy, nutritious food and that you can procure it in socially acceptable ways. So it goes beyond just, you know, whether or not you're starving, of course. It's really about how healthy your lifestyle is vis-a-vis food. And so when you look at the types of jobs that a lot of restaurant workers are doing, they are just not economically secure enough in their everyday lives to really have security in their diet and what they, you know, how they consume food and purchase food.
So. And I guess just let me take a step back here. I think it's important. The study being published by the Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York, RockNY, and the Food Chain Workers Alliance and Food First. Let's take a step back for a moment and just describe who these groups are.
Yeah. Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York, they have been doing a lot of organizing work in the New York City area with restaurant workers for a long time. As you might know, there's a very low unionization rate in the restaurant workforce, and yet it's one of the really key parts of New York City's economy. So they've been doing outreach to workers. They have helped them organize, do various workplace justice campaigns. They've also helped to educate and engage restaurant employers to make sure that they can adhere whenever possible to, you know, good labor practices. This kind of research is part of their overall comprehensive approach. It's just, you know, there are a ton of interesting findings here, but among the surveys that they did, and just to clarify, this was focusing on workers in the Bay Area and in New York. So that's where the 1 in 3 statistic came from. They found that, you know, the wages and the schedules and the benefits that in restaurant work are so meager and so inconsistent that it puts them at a higher rate of food insecurity, a much higher rate of food insecurity than is estimated for the general population of workers.
And when you write about San Francisco and you talk about food workers who work in organic and sustainable restaurants, that 22% more likely to be food insecure. And that, for me, when I read that line, it raised so many contradictions about the world of foodies and good food advocates and making healthier food for the planet and the people. Yet the poor people, mostly women and people of color who are serving this food or preparing this food, are food insecure. I mean, there's a certain madness to that.
There is. It's definitely, as you said, it's an oxymoron. But in reality, I mean, it seems contradictory. And yet, if you look at the way our food system functions and how incredibly dysfunctional it is, it really makes perfect sense. The fact that, you know, I guess, like in Marxist terms, it's the classic crisis of overproduction and underconsumption. Mm-hmm. You have this mass of workers at the bottom who are basically unable to procure for themselves any of the fruits of their labor, literally.
Literally, exactly.
Yeah. And so, yeah, this definitely underscores in a contemporary context, you know, how our current economy, you know, this kind of insecurity is kind of part of the status quo. And these workers just have to deal with it every day because these are often the only jobs they have. Or, you know, they get stuck in a rut. Maybe, you know, they're facing a lot of debt. They can't move on to a more stable position. Or simply just the fact that their wages are so low that they're just living paycheck to paycheck barely. And so if you're barely scraping by, you can't even, you know, find time to spend time with your family, much less cook a good meal for them. You know what I mean? And one of the really interesting things is just, you know, to the extent that the consumption aspect of this and the labor aspect of this intersect, a lot of workers reported that they simply had to eat at the restaurant like they were being sort of like paid in kind with the food that they're serving. They kind of got to eat like the leftover, you know, the group meal that they sort of put out there. that's like kind of maybe the subpar stuff that they feed the staff, but you know, people rely on that meal, you know? And so it's just, it's almost kind of, in a way it seems so regressive, you know, we have wage workers here and yet they're basically working for food.
It almost harkens back to a darker period in America, and it's like being reborn. I mean, when you look at in the question, especially what you raised earlier in your article, you raise it that only 2% of food workers are organized by unions or in unions, I should say. Yeah. I mean, that's an incredibly low number. I mean, I know unions are in bad shape in America at the moment and struggling to make an effect on different industries. But this particular number, 2%, so why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, it's a bit of a chicken and the egg system, right? It's a vicious cycle. The more insecure workers are, the higher the turnover is at restaurants. You know, workers who are miserable all the time and afraid of what their bosses will do to them are not going to stand up for their labor rights. And also the workforce is, you know, not only are they impoverished, but they often work these crazy erratic schedules. And so when you're not even, you know, you may not even get enough hours to really be full time. You might be cobbling together a bunch of part-time jobs. And so therefore, you know, if your employment situation is that unstable, it's hard to, you know, even have a basis for organizing because you're not in a single workplace for long enough. But also B, when all the workers in a workplace are struggling, it's hard for them to connect and really get together and, you know, plan things like a unionization campaign. And it's just hard to get that critical mass going. So, you know, it's a vicious cycle of sorts.
I'm very curious about the headway. I know here in Baltimore, other places, there have been some serious organizing efforts at airports with food workers and other places, and there's a real push by certain unions to make that happen. It seems to me that's part of the solution to what we're facing. But what?
Absolutely.
I'm curious what some of the other proposals are to address this directly.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point you made about unionization is key, I think, because they also found in their surveys that having some sort of workplace organization, whether it's like organizing through something like Rock New York or organizing through formal unions, such as, you know, Unite Here is the big restaurant workers union, food services union in New York, that's able to give, that gives workers the ability to have a voice at work and have some control over their working situation and their schedules and whatnot. But beyond that, there are also legislative measures that can be passed on a local level or state level or even a federal level that will provide more income security, more economic security, and therefore more stability in terms of people's eating habits and their access to food. Like currently right now, as you, some of your listeners may know, for workers who are tipped, such as restaurant servers and bartenders and the like, they work for a federal sub-minimum wage. So the federal government basically allows, you know, employers to kind of lowball the minimum wage on the assumption that the rest will be made up in tips. So their federal sub-minimum wage is $2.13 an hour. I mean, you think, you know, the current regular minimum wage is low enough, but
right,
when you think about people being allowed to have a base pay to start with at $2.13 and then build up from that solely on the basis of tips, you know, that is widely credited for destabilizing wages and depressing wages overall in the service workforce. And, you know, things like workplace discrimination, having stronger protections against that, having an ability for regulatory authorities to enforce those things, can help prevent workers from really being screwed by their bosses because, you know, there's huge gender segregation. There's also racial discrimination in hiring. So, you know, the more these types of biases keep those workers down, the harder it is to really empower them and give them control, not only over their working conditions, but also, as we can see from the report, you know, their overall health and their overall lifestyle when it comes to having access to real nourishment.
I mean, it seems to me that in so many combination of things it would take to kind of really address this, with, from unions to the kind of policy push you're talking about that Rock in New York does and other groups do, because you allude to the fact in here that, I mean, it's a very powerful organization, the other NRA, the National Restaurant Association, that I mean, people, I think really we've begun to talk about this in this program a number of times, but people don't get a sense of how powerful this group is and the role it plays in holding all this action back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of the biggest lobbying forces in Washington, and it's, you know, generally not as well known as the NRA, the big NRA. But, you know, they've done a lot of Herman Cain actually was former head of the NRA. But, you know, they have done a lot of lobbying to do things like keep the minimum wage down or lobby against the efforts on the local level to raise the minimum wage. They've been able to sort of stealthily keep those efforts down, things that would really, you know, raise the overall pay scales in the workforce. And then, you know, they kind of, their public face is that they represent, you know, the small businesses, right? The mom and pop, you know, taverns and, you know, the like old timey diners or whatever. And they neglect to mention, of course, that a lot of these big players in the industry are chains, essentially. I mean, they're franchises and you know, everything from fast food to top-end, you know, white tablecloth restaurants. And so the system really operates pretty effectively when you're talking about, you know, how they can wield political forces in their favor and perpetuate these systematic violations of workers' labor rights. And, you know, the more organized the employers are, the more impossible it becomes for the workers to get organized themselves. And so for any change to really happen, I mean, food insecurity is just kind of a symptom of a deeper malaise. You really need to start with worker empowerment.
Where does the media take this from here? In our role here to look at this and expose this, to bring it to the fore.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are actually a lot of really interesting organizing efforts going on within the food industry. You know, it should be mentioned that this type of food insecurity is prominent and it's prevalent throughout the food workforce, whether it's, you know, farm workers or food processing workers or the distribution workers. I mean, you know, people are struggling at every end of the supply chain. And, you know, some sectors have been more effective in unionizing than others. And there are always interesting campaigns going on. I mean, you've probably seen the news about fast food workers organizing, right? That's
right.
Another end of the restaurant industry, kind of the low end, that has historically been incredibly difficult to organize because of the franchise system. And now they're actually getting some headway. I mean, they don't have a union yet, but they're definitely making demands and they're getting organized, you know, across different companies, across different cities, you know. So if you can get creative about it, there are ways to engage workers and make them more aware of their rights and make them aware of how the industry is basically forcing them to go hungry. And it's a human rights issue, you know? So, and I think restaurant consumers as well, just in terms of, you know, knowing what restaurant employers are doing, Rock New York and Food First, they kind of work on the consumer end too. Help make consumers more aware of which restaurants adhere to fair employment practices. They call them sort of the high road employers. And so if you have a good restaurant boss out there, you want to bring your business to them and not, you know, not take your business to, you know, employers who mistreat their labor. So there are individual choices that you can make as well.
Now that's a critical component. I mean, all levels of this, whether it's union organizing, making public aware, the kind of public policy pushes to change the rules that have happened in certain parts of the country, as you've written about, but also people, just regular folks who go out for meals, just inquiring in the restaurant themselves, pushing the restaurant,
yeah,
letting them know that we know.
Definitely. And also, the one interesting thing, too, is that it all kind of intersects when it comes to public health. One of the big issues that is flagged in the report as an obstacle to food security or a potential obstacle is a lack of paid sick leave. And, of course, when workers can't get time off from work to nurse themselves back to health and they fall ill, well, guess who's going to be coughing and sneezing on your salad, you know? I mean, everyone's put at risk when workers don't have rights. And so by recognizing how these different parts of the system fit together, there are ways to really improve the economy for everyone, whether you're eating or you're the one serving.
But I'm really glad you wrote this. This is going to create, should be creating a lot of discussion. And we're definitely going to link to this on the Steiner Show page and our Soundbites page by Michelle Chen. Nearly one in three restaurant workers suffer from food insecurity. And we'll have that up on our website. I want to thank Michelle Chen, who wrote this piece for The Nation, is also a contributing editor to In These Times and co-producer of the Asia-Pacific Forum on Pacific's WBAI and does the Belabor podcast for Dissent Magazine. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Tom Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. From Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.